a homeless disaster. And the meeting is now in progress. Thank you for coming. We welcome you most warmly. Gail Miller is the other co-chair. She's not able to attend in person today, but she is attending electronically. We're glad to have her with us. She's, of course, a recognized force in the community, in the philanthropic world, and in public service. We're grateful to be using her facilities today. And on behalf of her and the council, we welcome all of you. Thank you very, very much. We'll begin this meeting with a roll call. Stephanie Leeds is going to check to make sure who's here. We're going to do a head count. Stephanie, please.
Okay. Wayne Niederhauser.
Here.
Whitney Clayton.
Here.
Gail Miller. Tiffany Price.
Here.
Bonnie Keir.
Here.
Randy Shumway.
Yes, ma'am.
Aaron Litbeck or Jenny Wilson.
Here.
Mayor Cherie Wood.
Here.
Mayor Erin Mendenhall.
Here.
Mayor Michelle Randall.
Here.
Mayor Mike Caldwell. Mayor Robert Hale.
I'm here.
David Litbeck, doing business as Tracy Gruber.
Here.
Sophia DeCaro. Casey Cameron.
Here.
Nate Checkitz. Brian Nielsen.
Here.
Senator Jacob Andreg. Representative Steve Elison.
Here.
Sydney Dixon.
Here.
Pamela Atkinson.
Here.
Kim Diener.
Here.
Peggy Green.
Here.
Rob Lesseman.
Here.
Heather Hoag.
Here.
Stephanie Jones.
Here.
And Brian Higgins.
Here.
And this does establish a quorum.
Thank you very much. This is a history-making meeting, the first meeting of the Utah Homelessness Council. It's an auspicious beginning, I think, and we're going to have a great meeting. People are well prepared. We invite your collaboration and cooperation all the way through the meeting. We should be better served by the end of the meeting than we are at the beginning. So with that, we're pleased, very pleased to have the director, the coordinator, I think is the right term, coordinator of the Utah Homelessness Office and everything that's going on in terms of the professional staff. We're grateful to have Senator Niederhauser with us. We'll turn the time to him. He has the first matter on the agenda. Senator Niederhauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to just talk a little bit about how we've got here for a moment, and then talk to you a little bit about my first 120 days on the job. So there was a Kim Gardner Institute discussion or work group that the legislature, I guess, mandated in 2021 we get a group together of stakeholders and decide about governance for homelessness, for homeless services. That was led by Natalie Gochner. I happen to be on that, and I see many of you were also on that in that group discussion. And the result of that was House Bill 347 that was run by Representative Eliason. And it wasn't absolutely smooth, Representative, right?
Not quite.
Pretty smooth.
Not as much as I would have wished, but it's usually the way it is.
Yeah, there was, I guess, some confusion on initial draft, but then the draft that did pass with a few amendments is what we have in statute today. And we created a new chapter in code. We never take chapters away, but we always create new ones in the legislature. And the new chapter is homeless services. And under there, lists my responsibilities as the coordinator, state homeless coordinator, lists the responsibilities of the State Office of Homeless Services, which was mostly staff, at least, was under housing, under workforce services. Now it's been separated out, at least optically, and we function now in a more autonomous way to coordinate the homeless services on a state level. So our objective is statewide. And Tricia is going to probably talk a little bit more about the governance, so I won't get too involved or talk too much about the statewide governance, but it's important that everybody knows, and I think most of you do here, but maybe some of the public that's weighing in today will want to understand, maybe a few board members, how homeless services is governed in the state. The new part is that we have the Office of Homeless Services as a separate entity to some degree, and we're to coordinate across departments. That's public safety, that's corrections, that's workforce services, and that's health and human services, as well as budget. And we have Sophia DeCaro, who's the state budget director, who is on this council. So all these come together because when we talk about homeless services, it crosses these departmental lines. And it's and the way that at least the best practices that at least has informed this legislation was that there be more coordination across these lines. And that's why we have the COCs, and that's why we have the LHCs, formerly called the LHCCs, which Tricia will talk about, is our coordinating councils. The system works better when we're coordinating. And that's why we have this governance model. Now, if you look across the country, homeless services is usually under housing. And that makes a lot of sense, because we're talking about homeless services, and the antithesis of being homeless is being housed. And so I think over time, all the efforts, and I would, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that probably 90% of the efforts across the country on a state level is under housing. I know it is in Arizona, I know it is in California. I'm not sure if anybody's done what's Utah's done and separated that office out, but it's not very many states that have done it that way. Because I think we recognize that although housing is an important part of ending homelessness, because we're talking about housing, we know that that's just a milestone. It's much more than that. We're talking about people re-entering into society after being in the correction system or being in jail. We're talking about domestic violence. We're talking about foster children, a high percentage of which leave that system and end up homeless or experiencing homelessness. It's mental illness, the very core of the problem that we are facing is mental illness, mental health, behavioral health, and of course, drug addiction. Now, there's probably another few more situations I could mention. It's a pretty big spectrum of reasons of situations why people end up experiencing homelessness, one of which is intergenerational poverty. And so this is our challenge. And housing has not been an easy effort. Right now we're running at a fairly high capacity at our resource centers, at least in Salt Lake, but I think statewide. And I want to emphasize once again that this is a statewide office. It's a statewide problem, and we're looking at this and the eyes of are looking at it as a statewide issue. Now, it seems to be more optical in places like in Salt Lake County, but I've been from Logan to St. George. I've been out in Tooele, Utah County, and there are homeless issues, people that are experiencing homelessness in every one of those areas. Unfortunately, it seems to be centered in the, which I call it, the center city of those areas. So that'd be like St. George or Logan, it'd be Ogden, Salt Lake. But here in Salt Lake, you know, Midvale has a shelter, Mayor Hell, and I know that South Salt Lake probably impacted more than anybody in the state because they have the men's shelter and they have a very small population. They also have other providers in Midvale, in South Salt Lake. So this is the challenge that we have, and now coordinating those services so that we now can look towards even better outcomes. One thing that I have noticed as I've gone around the state is that systems are functioning, I think, pretty well. The legislative audit that came out in May, a lot different than the one in 2018. So things, I believe, are functioning. People are doing a lot of good things. But coordination, I still feel, based on what I've seen, can be improved. And I think we can all agree to that. And hopefully now with the Office of Homeless Services, it has a statewide mandate, we can coordinate that effort on a statewide basis, bringing the resources across the spectrum of departments and divisions on the state. Now, as far as our responsibilities as the Homeless Council, I'm just going to read from the statute a couple of lines so we all know what our responsibilities are as a council. The council shall provide final approval for the homeless services budget, the strategic plan. Now, we have a strategic plan, and that was put together a couple of years ago. Even though it's fairly new, I believe it needs to be updated, and that will be a responsibility of this council. Our office will do the work with the support of Workforce Services, putting together some proposals, maybe some presentations, but this is going to be one of our main objectives, is to look at the strategic plan and see where that needs to be changed. One thing I noticed, it seems to be focused almost completely on housing. It does talk about services, but I think we need to recognize in our strategic plan that housing is a milestone and that we need to address those underlying issues with a lot of energy, because if we can improve someone's mental health, their behavioral health, we've not only hopefully housed them, but we've changed, that their lives are changed. And that's what I see as success, when people's lives are changed. They shall also approve the awarding of funding for provisions of homeless service. I won't go into that. In cooperation with the coordinator, develop and maintain a budget, strategic plan, review applications, and approve funding for provisions of homeless services, shall review local and regional plans for providing services to individuals, shall cooperate with homeless councils as designated by the Utah Homeless Network to develop common agenda and vision for reducing homelessness in each local oversight body's respective region. I think that's code word for LHC or COC. As part of the homeless service budget, develop a spending plan that coordinates that funding supplied to local stakeholders. Align local funding to projects that improve outcomes and target specific needs in each community. Shall coordinate gap funding with private entities for providing services to individuals experiencing homelessness. So this is getting together with our partners in the private sector and try and find alignment and unity and purpose with what they're doing. The system can only function better if there's more alignment with the private sector also. Shall recommend performance and accountability measures for service providers, including the support of collecting consistent and transparent data when reviewing and giving final approval or requests. I think that's there's some other language there, and if you're really wanting to look at that, see chapter 16 of the Utah Code. But I've hit on the highlights of our responsibilities there. It's about a strategic plan, it's about coordination, and it's about budget, and it's about working together, and that will be our objective. That is an update, at least. I've been around the state and have discovered that this is not just a Central City problem. It's every community, every part of this state needs to have a little bit of skin in the game, because it's a statewide issue. It's a countywide issue and not just a Central City issue. And so some of the things that I would like to see us work on is trying to get more of the community involved, more cities engaged, because what I see in some places is, that's really not our problem. That's such and such a city's problem, because they're the Central City, and it really isn't that way. And the well-functioning local homeless councils that I see are ones that are functioning on more of a county level than on a city level, because that's where the coordination should be, bringing all cities and all resources of the county together to help us make lives better and help people change their lives. I will leave it at that. Well, first of all, let me just say, is there any questions you have for me? I'm happy to address any questions. I think there will also be some, we'll talk about legislation that might be proposed in the next session or in future sessions. We might be talking about budgets that are hopefully issues that are money that, in addition to what we're getting, we'd like to obviously expand that. I've been working heavily upon housing. I know that's going to be an important part of what we do. Nobody's going to heal. Nobody's going to be able to really have be able to change their life unless they get into a stable housing situation. And we need to look at some models, because a lot of ongoing money is just not going to be available. I think we can do some incremental increases, but just knowing how the legislature works and the demands, education, transportation, It's going to be really hard to get a lot of ongoing money, but anyway, I'm working on some ideas where we can maybe build some of that into the housing, and we'll present some of that in our next meeting. I think that comes up in November. So any questions?
Hearing none, then let me just express gratitude present for the report and for the remarkable amount of ground you've covered in 120 days.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much. You're entitled to take a nap with a minute. So we'll turn next to Tricia Davis, the Assistant Director of the Office of Homeless Services, who will make a presentation to us. Tricia, we're in your hands. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Hello, Council. It's going to be a shift for me. This has been a committee for many years, so we will make that shift in my mind. Steph, I might need tech support. We'll see.
I did add you as a panelist, and you should be able to share.
Okay. Let's see, Mr. Chair, while I'm pulling this up, I was wondering if, do we want to go around and just do quick introductions and who everybody's here representing?
Surely we can do that. Let's I think we've heard from President Niederauer, so let's go on to Brian Higgins, please. Brian?
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Higgins. I am on the Council for Lived Experience of being homeless. I was homeless 7 years ago for about 18 months. I've since founded a nonprofit that works in mental health, creativity, and mental health to help people visualize and experience happy endings in their stories and move forward and hopefully move forward. So happy to be here. Bit scared.
We're lucky to have Brian with us, and it'll be a great asset to inform us on a great perspective that we need to have at the table.
Brian, thanks for being here. I'm Randy Shumway. I believe my appointment on the council is representing the philanthropic community.
Mayor Robert Hale, Midvale City. We're privileged to have the children's shelter in our city that houses homeless families with children. Thank you. Pamela?
Pamela Atkinson, community advocate and advisor to Governor Cox.
Representative Steve Elison, I am the appointee for the Speaker of the House.
I'm Rob Westman. I'm a co-chair for the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness.
Peggy Green, Executive Director, Iron County Care and Chair, representing private service providers.
Erin Mendenhall, Mayor of Salt Lake City.
Heather Holt, I am the collaborative applicant for the Mountain Land Continuum of Care, which is Utah County, Summit County, and Wasatch County.
Tiffany Price, appointed by the governor. And hopefully just representing your community and the.
How about online?
May I just inject, though, that having Senator Andrake and Representative Elison, we are very fortunate to have both of these individuals, because these are the ones that have worked on these issues for many years. They understand a lot of the nuances, and having them here, I know Representative Elison really has taken a deep dive into mental health over the years. He was on the board, or still maybe on the board of the Road Home, and so he has a lot of experience, very informed legislator on homeless services, and we're just fortunate to have both of these individuals on our council.
Before we go online.
Oh, you actually want me to say something?
There he is, right there.
Oh, yeah. I'm not too worried about it. I am Senator Andrake, and I'm going to be working to help get the funding associated with this through the legislature, being the chair of the Social Services Appropriations Subcommittee. So I'm honored to be here working on this important issue.
So online, I am going to go in alphabetical order. We have Bonnie Keir.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Keir Herrick. I've been nominated as the one of the philanthropic members of the council, and I currently co-own Cure Property Management in Ogden, Utah.
Next, we have Brian Nielsen.
Hi, Brian Nielsen with Department of Corrections, and very happy to be here and contribute in any way that I can.
Next, we have Casey Cameron.
I am Casey Cameron, and I'm the Executive Director of Workforce Services, and happy to support the good work of Wayne and Tricia and anything else that needs to be discussed. Thank you.
And next, we have Mayor Sheree Wood.
I'm Mayor Sheree Wood, and I represent South Salt Lake City. Thank you.
And then we have David Litvak, doing business as Tracy Grover.
Good afternoon. I'm David Litvak, Deputy Director of the Department of Human Services, here on behalf of the Executive Director, Tracy Grover. Human Services is really excited to be a part of this council. Thank you.
And next, we have Elliot Clark.
Hi, guys. Elliot Clark. I'm the Assistant Attorney General who represents this council. So nice to meet everyone and looking forward to working with you guys.
Erin Litvak, doing business as Jenny Wilson.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Erin Litvak, Deputy Mayor, Chief Administrative Officer for Salt Lake County, and I'm representing Mayor Wilson today at this meeting. Thank you for having me.
Next is Gail Miller.
Good afternoon. I'm Gail Miller. I'm a member of the council and happy to do what I can to help in the homeless realm.
Heather Borski, doing business as Nate Checkett.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Heather Borski, Deputy Director at the Utah Department of Health, and I'm representing our Executive Director, Nate Checkitz, and like others, very happy to be here today. Thank you.
Kim Dieter.
Hi, I'm Kim Dieter. I'm the Community Services Director with the UN Basin Association of Governments, representing the Tri-County area here in Uinta, Duchesne, and Daggett counties.
Mayor Michelle Randall.
Hi, I'm Mayor Michelle Randall from St. George.
Sophia DeCaro.
Hi, Sophia DeCaro with the Governor's Office of Planning and Budget.
Stephanie Jones.
Hi, Stephanie Jones, past chair of the Balance Estate. And I want to just publicly acknowledge that the statewide perspective that Wayne talked about. I'm really excited to work on that with all of you.
And Sydney Dixon.
Hi, good afternoon. Sydney Dixon, Utah State Superintendent of Public Instruction, representing public education and our Board of Education. And you will also see on the call Jeff Ojeda. We have a specialist dedicated to serving students who are experiencing homelessness.
Right. I hope that was beneficial for everyone. I was just thinking that we may want to do that. All right, so I'm Tricia Davis, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Office of Homeless Services. Wayne talked a little bit about how House Bill 347 changed some of the structure for us. We were previously in Housing and Community Development, in the Department of Workforce Services, and have been taken out of Housing and Community Development, but are now an office still within Department of Workforce Services from really an administrative support perspective. We have resources there, communications, HR, our data team with workforce research and analysis. And so that will be, I think, helpful for all of us as we move forward and plan. And I'll show you a slide here in just a moment. If I can get it to work, we'll see. Okay. This is like your 101 about how what's happening with the Office of Homeless Services and how the state is structured currently. It is important to understand these acronyms as a council. This is not all of them. We sometimes speak our own language, but these are the top, probably however many are here. COC is Continuum of Care. I'll talk more about what that means. HMIS is the Utah Homeless Management Information System. HUD. We're referring to our federal partners with the U.S. Housing and Urban Development. LHC is Local Homeless Council. UHC is you, the Utah Homeless Council, previously known as the State Homeless Coordinating Committee, but a very different group of people, some the same, some different. Let's see, SPM is, we do a lot of work around system performance measures with our U.S. HUD federal partner. And DVSP is Domestic Violence Service Provider. So if you see that at all through this presentation, hopefully you've got that in your mind now. So the state is currently, this is how the state is structured around homeless services and homeless service coordination. We have three COCs. You met the representatives here on the council that represent those COCs. There's the Balance of State, Mountain Land, and Salt Lake. The Salt Lake County COC plays a few different roles. It is also called the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness. It also is our local homeless council, right? So there is a group of people. It is a coordinated effort that really serves multiple roles. We have Mountain Land Local Homeless Council. Heather did a great job of, in her introduction, saying which counties that she is here representing. And that Mountain Land serves as the LHC and the COC. And then there's the Balance of State COC, which is 11 different local homeless councils. So the Balance of State is 25 counties throughout the state. This map represents each LHC, local homeless council. As Wayne talked about that, you can see where he's been all around the state, visiting with the LHCs around the state. Wayne mentioned that we currently have a strategic plan, and you do have access to this slideshow. It's a link on the agenda if you are online. And if you need it to be sent, please let me know. The current strategic plan, it's also on our website. It's really focused around making homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring. And that's something that we talk about a lot. You've possibly, hopefully heard that before. The local homeless councils throughout the state, it's really our mantra, is we're focused on making homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring. Wayne mentioned we're looking at the strategic plan with the council. We'll be developing that and making some changes to it. This is a lot. I won't read through it word for word, but I think it's important for you as a council to understand the responsibilities of the Office of Homeless Services. We are, and I'll just do the highlights, the funding administration for state and federal funding around homelessness. So that's through funding that we receive from the U.S. Housing and Urban Development, and then funding that is appropriated and are allocated from the legislature. And so we, with the council, coordinate that funding. We release the request for proposals, review the request for proposals, and then we manage those contracts. So that involves a lot of budget negotiation with service providers, payment processing, the federal and state reporting, and yeah, just the getting those contracts out. We're working on that right now. Each COC has what is called a collaborative applicant. And that is an entity that's been designated by the COC to run a federal funding process. That federal funding process, we don't have contracts directly with service providers for that funding process. They are directly with HUD. So for the Salt Lake COC, Salt Lake County is the designated collaborative applicant. So Salt Lake County staff help run that process. For Mountain Land COC, it's the United Way of Utah County, and Heather is employed by the United Way of Utah County, who is the collaborative applicant for that federal process for Mountain Land. And for the Balance of State, the Office of Homeless Services has been designated as the collaborative applicant for that federal funding. So we have staff that help coordinate that process. That funding opportunity was just released within this last week by HUD. And so that is something that all three COCs are currently working on.
Tricia, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
In other states, operating continuums of care, maybe, and how to say a state might be relative to ours is obviously variable, but are there paid staff typically for the COCs? And you're saying it in a really nice way, but what you're saying is none of these COCs have paid staff. Their staff are being supported by the bandwidth and generosity of other organizations, really?
So a couple, I'll clarify this. So for the COC planning, there is what's called a planning grant that is attached to that federal funding. And so there is some funding for staffing from the COC level. When we come down to the LHC level, the LHC, thank you for bringing that up. Local homeless councils is a Utah-specific term. I think it was probably about 15 years ago, with the work of Lloyd Pendleton, many of you know Lloyd, he helped to designate the state into smaller councils, Mayor, so that work could be coordinated more locally. The COC structure is really a HUD structure. Our LHC structure is a Utah structure. So because of that, there is some funding, it's not a lot, to do the planning around the COC work. But on a local level, as we drill down farther, there are local homeless councils that have people who are designated that have many different hats. I might use Peggy Green, right to your right, as an example. Peggy is really leading a lot of the work that's happening in Iron LHC. She's also the executive director of an agency. I always say, luckily, her board supports that work. Does that answer your question?
Yes, except for the other states. So if there are LHCs mm-hmm. in other states, whatever that equivalent is, do they typically have supportive staff?
So interestingly, we are one of the only states that has designated farther down beyond the balance of state.
Interesting.
So there, I think probably every other state has a balance of state, which is a lot of counties. Like Texas, their balance of state is really good.
There is at least one exception that I know of. So the Weber Morgan LHC, the county leads that. Commissioner Jenkins, our former colleague in the Senate, he leads that. And they've created what's called the Center of Excellence. And they have two paid staff. Now, that staff. Does more than just LHC work, but at least their model is they have some paid supportive staff at an LHC level.
Through the county.
Through the county.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
And Mountainland might be a little bit similar to that as well, where because Mountainland is the LHC and the COC, there's a little bit more support for the work that's happening around coordination. Is that fair to say, Heather?
Yeah. The planning grant is, I'm a grant-funded physician as the collaborative applicant, the COC lead, but I'm housed out of United Way of Utah County, which is a non-competing agency, so they never asked for federal or for state funding, so that puts me in a place to be able to advocate a little bit without self-interest.
I would say for Salt Lake County, and Rob, please correct me if I'm wrong, the work that's being done around coordination with the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness, also known as the Local Homeless Council, there are additional resources that are going into the staffing on a county level for that work.
Thanks for that clarification.
Okay, the next thing on the list of things that we do, the COCs designate a system administrator for the Utah Homeless Management Information System. That system is really our main system for collecting data related specifically to literal homelessness. And so the COCs have designated also the Office of Homeless Services to administrate that system. I talked a little bit about system performance measures. There's a lot that is done around reporting our system performance measures to the federal government. And we have tried to align some of what we're reporting for our performance on a state level with the legislature. We're trying to align some of that because it's a lot that goes into that reporting. We also help coordinate with the COCs and support the point in time count and the housing inventory counts, which typically happen once a year, the second to last week of January. And that starts to be a really popular talking point for people around the state. And I might have Joseph talk a little bit more about that when he gives his update. And we're also responsible for, we released the Utah Annual Report on Homelessness, which is a data focused report. And that can be found online, and I will show you where to find that. We help organize, so around education and training. I think many of you in this room have attended the annual homelessness summit, and this year will be our 18th annual summit. That's a training opportunity, the only large conference that's held for homeless service providers, policymakers. It's a pretty vast, kind of group of people that attend that summit. And we hold that every year. This year it will be in November. And so we would invite you to attend that. It will be virtual again this year as well. And we do a lot of training around HMIS. We provide technical assistance and program support to service providers around the state. And then I talked about strategic planning a little bit. We are the staff support for you as a council. We also help support the local homeless councils and any funding allocation committees that need help and support when we're talking about funding distribution. Capacity building with the LHCs, talked about balance of state. There are different committees that we run. One is, or a couple of them are, the Utah Homeless Management Information System Steering Committee that we help support as a staff. Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS Steering Committee. That's a specific funding source that we'll talk a little bit more about. We are working on getting together a data leadership committee, and many of you on this council will receive requests to have staff from your departments participate in that as we talk more about different data sources around homelessness and how we can really stop just using HMIS and think about this more systematically. The Utah Homeless Network Steering Committee, which I'll talk about, we had a COVID response committee that met every single week for about a year and a half, and that was a statewide group. We were coordinating and co-facilitated with me by Pamela Atkinson, and that was a great support as we were coordinating resources over COVID. All right, so you can just get to know or see, maybe it's not switching. Oh, now I'm going too far. Sorry guys, hold on. There we go. It's going very slow. Now, Steph, I don't see share screen. Sorry, guys. Or am I missing it? Sorry, technical difficulties here. I'm just going to keep it up like this. Everyone see it okay? Very small on those other screens. This is our office, just so you can see how we are structured right now. So our connection to the Department of Workforce Services and our connection to the Governor's Office of Planning and Budget with our fearless homelessness coordinator, Wayne Niederhauser. I am the assistant director. We have two teams. We have a program team and a data team. And our staff are mostly, I think we're all here, right here on this row. We've got our, with our program team, our program manager, Russell Goodman. Raise your hand, Russell. There he is. On our data team, we've got Joseph Jensen. There's Joe. And Lainey. Mary. Carol. Kelly. Haley. Michelle. Lynn. And Zach. That's us. All right, I'm going to skip down to here. Getting into the meat. Okay. Funding. Oh man, I'm not. This is not. Look, I could be just, I would be just fine if this was just a virtual meeting, I promise. Okay, just to give you a snapshot of where our funding was at in January, we have a document that we're going to look at today as a council, just to show you where we're at with funding. The funding that's listed there with the stars, that is mainstream, what we call our mainstream funding that we release in one RFP. So the mainstream funding is funding from federal and state sources. It was prioritized by the local homeless councils. And so the state homeless coordinating committee had an allocation committee. We asked every member from this past committee, now council, to participate on what we called an allocation committee. And so everybody designated a person that was a voting member on the state homeless coordinating committee into that process. And then farther down, the local homeless councils had committees that they had without conflicts involved and service providers to make the determinations and recommendations to the state homeless coordinating committee for funding. We will come back to that. That process, I think that this is important for this council to understand. Just the past and where we're at in this process. The LHCs presented their project priorities in February of 2020. Their RFP was released in February 2020. Recommendations from the State Homeless Coordinating Committee, like the allocation group, and the LHCs were made to the State Homeless Coordinating Committee and approved on April 22nd. Recommendations for contract renewal happened in just this past June, June 10th, with the State Homeless Coordinating Committee. So contracts were approved in June for 1 year with the option of a renewal. When we released this RFP with the State Homeless Coordinating Committee, that committee voted and approved to have basically do 3 year contracts. So 1 year contracts with the option of 2 renewals. There was a lot of discussion and conversation around doing that because we had in the past released an RFP every year, which is an incredible amount of work for this council and an incredible amount of work for our office and for the local homeless councils. Doing this 3 year cycle also helped kind of stabilize what might be happening with the service provider. And that was part of the conversation with the committee at the time, in, you know, figuring out how we distribute resources as a council and as an office. Those contracts, so we're currently, this is fiscal year 22, we're in year 2 of 3 right now. So there will be 1 year left on that.
Tricia, yeah. Just clarification, The contracts do allow for some change. You know, if there was maybe something come down from the legislature or an audit or something like that. So even though we have three-year contracts, there is some flexibility with that. I think that's important for us all.
Can I ask a quick question? Maybe I'm talking about the same thing here. Maybe I'm not. But if I'm not, tell me I'm not. But there was a legislative fiscal audit done on all sources of funding for homelessness in the state. I think it came out in 2018, might have been 2019, but I think it was 2018. And it showed not 40 million, but more like 110 million. Right. So is what you're showing on this just those portions that have a discretionary component, both from federal HUD money as well as state money, but not showing any of the direct pass-through monies that are going, like, why isn't it showing 100 million plus?
Gotcha. This only represents the funding that our office is responsible for administering.
Okay.
So some of what was included in that, for example, the county receives a specific allocation of ESG CARES fund, ESG regular funding and CARES Act funding straight to the county. Right, they're administering that funding.
Because that, I think also that legislative audit was also lumping in and probably estimating a little bit philanthropic donations as well.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And I wonder if you want to talk about that.
This is a good time to bring this up also. In that audit, if I remember correctly, I haven't reviewed it, or I didn't think I'd ever review it again. But I remember the auditor saying that it's too widespread and it's hard to discover all the money that's being spent on homeless services. And so I know that Health and Human Services, a lot of the grants that they give out are also related to homeless services, or at least part of some of those grants. Mental health, behavioral health, maybe not specifically to people experiencing homelessness, but in the broad scheme of things. So there would be some of that funding. I think that was part of that discovery that the auditors tried to go through. Well, with this legislation, House Bill 347, there is also this effort now to try it again, see if we can reach out to all the nonprofits. Tyler Kane and Drew, I can't remember Drew's last name, at GOPB, has been working on trying to figure out beyond state what we can discover just within the state, how much we're spending on homeless services, out to the private sector. So they've been looking at 990s for providers, trying to figure out, because they're not real detailed either, trying to figure out how much. We've been briefed on that. I'm meeting with Tyler Kane on Friday to go over in more detail, because it's pretty complicated. But this is something that we're going to need to report back to the legislature, probably, hopefully, in an interim meeting before the session, probably October or November, at least so that the legislature knows what we have discovered. But it is, there's no way to do 100% comprehensive review, because there's a lot of individuals that don't take government funds and who are not necessarily refusing to be part of that. They just feel like that's private information.
Which I understand that, but that, if I may, that is one of the concerns I've seen, is that when we're around a coordinating council table, we are very polite and want to work with each other. But I have had several interactions where when it comes to competing for those philanthropic dollars or those direct grants, how many times I've been asked to open a legislative audit on this service provider, coming to me from a competitive service provider. And I'm throwing it out here to say, are we counseling and coordinating together to really get on the same page to address this? Or are we going to continue as is and slit each other's throats behind the scenes? Because I backed away from doing any other pushing for any other audits because I started to see that there was a little bit of cannibalism going on. And I want to say, if we're going to coordinate and really go after this under your direction of this, then let's do it, but let's maybe lay the groundwork that, and I think maybe the philanthropic groups might also have a side group that gets together that says, okay, here's what we're all going to put in and where are we going to stick our money so that there isn't this behind the scenes chaos happening. I'm just going to say it because I can't, so.
Well, and that's better coordination will actually help that and relieve some of that pressure, but I don't know if that pressure can ever be relieved in its entirety just because there's a limited amount of funds in the community.
Sure.
And a number out there competing for those people that are actually coordinating and people that are not coordinating. And, you know, it's the private sector. So, you know, you would appreciate how careful we'd want to be. We'd want to encourage people to come in and cooperate. But, you know, a mandate for that would probably the legislature would need to support that, I guess, just guessing. So, but at least we're going to try and have, we've got this effort, and GOPB has done a great job in bringing all the sources that they can. We'll have a report on that. We'll want to, you know, present that report probably in our next meeting also, so you've got an idea of what a bigger picture is as far as funding for local services. Is that?
Yeah. Just to talk a little bit more about the funding sources, this slide has a lot of acronyms. So you're the council, so you're going to need to understand all of these. ESG is Emergency Solutions Grant. And that is that's one of our federal funding sources from HUD. HOPWA, Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS, that's also a federal funding source from HUD. Temporary Assistance for Needy Families is TANF, and that is also a federal source. H2H is the Homeless to Housing Restricted Account, that's one of our state sources. There is legislative intent behind some of the H2H, which is specifically for shelter operations. And then Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund is PAHTF. All of these sources have different parameters.
And all of these sources are appropriated by the legislature, right?
The state ones, yeah, right.
But don't they appropriate the ESG funds?
So ESG is done through a federal formula allocated to states. Yeah, and then they do. Everything goes through the state.
The legislature.
Yeah. We release one RFP for our mainstream funding because of how complex it is on the parameter side around the different sources. We decided years ago to not have service providers have to worry about which source to apply for because it does get complicated. So we release the one RFP and then we figure out how, as council and local homeless councils, how each project can be funded with what source. And it takes some time. So that's just, I won't read through all of them, but just so you can get an idea about the different ways that those funding sources can be used. So it's not like we have one big pot of money, right, that we can just throw out there. Just to give you an idea, when we ran the RFP, because this is a new council and we're in year two of this, there was a $31.4 basically million dollars worth of requests. We had $19 million to work with. I bring that up because I think it does show the need that service providers are feeling as we coordinate these resources. Also, to give you an idea about what was funded, So this is just the mainstream funding that we're talking about, but you can see that there was a huge need for funding for emergency shelter. And that is throughout the state. And we found that that was the largest need. So as we're talking about wraparound services and supportive services, you know, it's something to keep in mind. Our funding as an office has been utilized for crisis response and has played that role in that purpose, which has been a need, right? We get this question a lot, especially during the legislative session. I thought that this might be an interesting exercise to do in this last session. We hear a lot about funding distribution. We've worked really hard as an office and as a council to get funding distributed across the state. As Wayne talked about, this homelessness is a statewide issue. And we as an state office should be thinking about it that way. One of the things that really helped us get funding distributed across the state was an influx of federal funding through the Emergency Solutions Grant, the CARES Act. And we were able to come up with a formula as a committee slash council and distribute funding by LHC for that funding. What you have here, so we've got our mainstream funding. This is fiscal year 21. I just want everyone to keep that in mind because we need to do an analysis about where we're at with 22. But you can see those last two columns, those the purple headings, that's fiscal year 21 percentage of funding of the funding we know about. So Senator, this doesn't include right Salt Lake County specific funding that they receive. This is just an analysis for our office and what we know about, and the COC funding, federal funding. So fiscal year 21% of funding compared to the percent of homeless according to the 2020 point in time count. So as we're looking at where needs may be and people experiencing homelessness, that is how our funding breaks out, our funding for fiscal year 21. This next slide will show you that same information in a different format. Because we heard as an office a lot during the legislative session that certain areas weren't getting their fair share of funding, right, to respond to homelessness. I think we've done a pretty good job. Again, it's the funding that is represented from our office. So,
and Grand did receive any?
Grand did receive $50,000. It's not showing up on this because it's just so small. But it's they received ESG CV funding. That's the CARES Act coronavirus response funding down there. Yep.
It's an interesting scale, 10 timesing.
I know. It was just to get it on.
It took me a minute.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Salt Lake County.
We talked about that as an office, but
it doesn't pass the SNP test. So how is homeless being defined in these calculations?
So the point in time count is it's that count that happens every January, right? And it is we felt pretty confident in using the 2020 point in time count numbers because it was the most organized count I think that we've had as a state to date. So it's one night, right? This is not taking into consideration how many people access services over a year, for example, which we're also
point in time count. It's counting people that are in shelters, people that are not in shelters.
Unsheltered and sheltered.
Yeah. Okay. Is there any way of calculating whether they would be categorized as chronically or episodically or situationally homeless? Yes,
that was captured in the 2020 point in time count.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Randy, you should know that we have large numbers of people who are homeless, but they're not counted as homeless. They're living in motels, and they very often get a job in the motel, and which pays them just enough for their rent and food. Yeah. And it's a vicious cycle for them because they want to save money to get into their own place. They don't want to go into the resource center. So they live there week after week after week, working at the motel until we find some way to rescue them and help them. And then you've also got homeless friends living, doubling up, tripling up, and even quadrupling up in the different houses round and about, rather than be out on the streets or in the centers that we have.
And those individuals would not have been counted in this situation.
They're never counted. They don't come under the federal guidelines, no.
I have one question. So the money thus spent includes money towards permanent supportive housing
for
in the state, and but those people aren't counted. So if there was more permanent supportive housing in one county, it would throw off the numbers a little bit because you're putting a lot of money towards that, but they're not counted as homeless people.
I'm going to let Joseph talk about what's included in the point in time count. Do you mind doing that?
Sure. Come up closer. So I'm Joseph Jensen. I'm the program or the data program manager within the Office of Homeless Service. And this is something that we have thought a lot about. And again, this was our initial effort to try to use a specific data point to see how we were doing as far as parity goes with our funding sources. The point in time count is not a perfect measure. Again, it's looking at a single night, and it is looking at the federal definition of literal homelessness. And so, like Tricia said, people who were either staying in a place not meant for human habitation, the streets, their car, something of that nature, in an emergency shelter, or in what is considered transitional housing. So it is not including people that are in our permanent housing projects and housed by those projects, even though we fund them. The reason we used this is because those individuals experiencing literal homelessness are the ones that we feel are the most vulnerable and need the most support from our homeless service system. Obviously, we want all of them to transition into permanent housing, whether through our permanent housing projects, through connections with their own social safety nets and systems, employment, those things. But we wanted to focus specifically on those people that meet that definition, because that's where there's the most need for immediate intervention and targeting from our housing projects. And so this is something we're still exploring. We're looking for ways to improve this process, but it helped us get a feel for what does this actually look like? Where do we have unmet needs there at that most basic level? And then we're looking forward to working with this council to create that state data leadership group to pull in the additional data sources, consider other definitions of homelessness, like the ones used by our partners in the Department of Education, under the McKinney-Bento definition that does include people doubled up, like Pamela was mentioning, to try to broaden that. But we also recognize that there is a more immediate and pressing need for a person who does not have a place to stay and is on the streets or in a shelter than even those who are doubled or tripled up. We want to get there, but we'd like to start with those people who meet that definition of literal homelessness.
And my only concern was, say that 30 million, hypothetically, say 10 million was put towards permanent supportive housing of the 30 million. That would skew those percentages if Salt Lake City or Salt Lake County had a lot more street homelessness. But a lot of the resources that they're getting are going to people who are already permanently supportive housed. It just would uneven those percentages.
And the one comment I'd make about that is, while some of that does go to supporting people who are already housed, our housing funding also goes to getting people who are currently literally homeless into those housing situations. So funding for housing projects, while it may not appear to be a crisis response or a literal homeless response in the way, same way that shelter does, ultimately those are some of our best tools for getting people out of that literally homeless situation. And so we want to fund that as a response to literal homelessness, not just as stabilization of people who are already in those housing projects.
So if I may ask one additional question, so would you say that this analysis, this point in time analysis, using a standard deviation model, is 80% of reality, 85%? What's our margin of error?
That is, honestly, that's the one great downfall of the point in time count. So the advantages of the point in time count is it pulls in people that normally are not seen by our HMIS or homeless management information system. People who are unsheltered and are not engaging with homeless service providers are counted to a greater degree in this count. It also pulls in people like our DVSPs, our domestic violence service providers, who are prohibited by law from entering into HMIS due to the security and safety needs for survivors seeking their services. It also allows us to engage with the few agencies that have opted not to participate in HMIS to this point. And so while it just looks at a single night, it's pulling in a broader swath of our literally homeless population. The downside to that is there's a lot that goes into determining whether a person experiences that definition of literal homelessness on a single night. If you had been staying in the shelter for 3 weeks, 3 months, a year, went and stayed with a friend for that one night, you may not show up. And so there is that opportunity for variation within it. And so we always have to take the point time count with a grain of salt, but we have undergone great strides in improving what that count looks like and making it more comprehensive. And so we do feel that while it's not perfect, and it definitely, for the most part, I would say that we often undercount people experiencing literal homelessness because it is difficult to locate those who are experiencing unsheltered homelessness. It's the best measure that we have in a single number to try to gather what that population may look like in a community.
Can I ask one other follow-up question to that?
Absolutely.
Is the point in time metric, is that a federally designated, or is that something that was set up through the state, or could we take that designation and broaden it?
So the answer is yes. So there is a federal, there's a federal definition. They mandate that we have to do a point in time count for this definition of literally homeless within the last 10 days of January. And so we need to carry that out. We need to submit that to HUD. We also have some local flexibility for things we wanted to do on top of that. So for example, some LHCs are preparing to do a fall count here in a few weeks. So we have some flexibility, but we do need to make sure that we are staying within, or at least fulfilling those federal mandates as well.
Was any of that flexibility because of the pandemic? Those last 10 days of January, I think, were our highest COVID numbers over the entire course of the pandemic. So there's a lot of caution with the volunteers going out, right? So was that flexibility pandemic related, or is it always there?
So there's always flexibility of what we want to do beyond what HUD is requiring. HUD did allow additional flexibility in methodology, expanding the time period we could collect information for the January 2021 point in time count. This one from 2020 did not have some of that same variation due to COVID concerns, and that's the reason we're still showing this here.
Okay.
Good. 45 minutes.
I know. I was just asking to see what time was.
Great.
Here's a plug. We would love volunteers throughout the state for the LHCs that are doing a fall point in time count. It is September 10th.
Yeah, I wanted
I'll to be there. 3 o'clock in the morning.
It was during the first week of the legislative session, so.
You were sleeping anyhow.
3 o'clock in the morning, friends. Yeah. Okay, I'm not going to go into too much detail about this because we need to get through the agenda. This section, if you look at it and you've got questions, how we are currently measuring success is through alignment with the system performance measures that we have and report to HUD. The strategic plan identified 3 of the 7+ measures that we report to for HUD to really look at how we're doing as a statewide system. Joseph will talk a little bit about our most current data report. The rest of the slides are that. Just really quick, this is a COC and Local Homeless Council best practice structure. Okay, so each LHC is working on having a boards and committees in place to do this work and coordinate on a local level. So you can see everyone who that includes. Really quick, Wayne mentioned the Utah Homeless Network. What is that? Now there's so many things, right? Utah Homeless Council, Utah Homeless Network, Local Homeless Council. Blah, blah. The Utah Homeless Network was developed. It was also in response to the strategic plan originally, but really we got going with it when we needed to respond to COVID and homelessness as a state. It really pushed us into motion. The Utah Homeless Network is all of the leadership, the chairs or the designees of the local homeless councils with our office, and we meet every other week. Okay, so this is our statewide coordination with our local homeless councils. You can see there's a slide who the representatives are for each LHC. You should all know, become familiar with this as a council. And then just a graphic, how it all fits together. So we've got the Utah Homeless Council, we've got the COCs, the LHCs. Each LHC has committees and task groups working on things. And we support the Utah Homeless Network and the Utah Office of Homeless Services. Okay, with that, I think because of time, I am not going to go to our websites, but please visit them. The Office of Homeless Services has a website, the Utah Homeless Council. You will have a website. This is also my plug. If you have not sent your bios and pictures to Steph, to please do that so that we can get them up on the website. And we will do that next time. One thing I need to mention is for housekeeping. There is a boards and commissions website. The link is on the agenda. We are not going to read through word for word the membership book that is on the boards and commissions website. That will be your personal responsibility. So please go there and check out that. That's for the state boards and commissions. Yeah.
So sorry, I would like to do one more moment of housekeeping just for public record. Will you share your screen again, any screen? So I just wanted to make clear, typically in these meetings, the chat function is disabled. The chat function is disabled. There was one that came through. I want to, for public record, show that it, oh, right there. Where does it show? There. Hold on one second. It asks that we share a list of acronyms, and I just wanted to show that for public record. So it just asked that there was a list of acronyms that was shared. That's the only thing that has been shown on there. So
okay,
just in the future, if you have a question, please ask it out loud.
I agree with Bonnie, though. Cheat sheet.
All right, look at you.
And I think Zach actually already has done that, so it'll be easy for us to send it out. And we'll be sending out Trisha's presentation for you, and please ask questions if you have.
And in the next meeting, there will be a test on the acronym.
100%. One more help. Sometimes on state commissions, I've appreciated the members of the council. Mm-hmm. And their associations listed on the agenda. Yep. Just for the next several meetings. Oh, anyway. Yep. Thank you.
We'll do that.
In the interest of expediting the meeting, we're going to have about a 10-second seventh inning stretch. Eight, nine, ten. The next item on the agenda is President Niederhauser's assignment to discuss a matter involving HB 440 and the 2020 general legislative session. President Niederhauser, please.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. So this is a proposal. Does everybody have this sheet? I think it's in the back of your packet. So they're going to go over a lot of the details of these are our final, I guess, are their final budget numbers?
Yes.
Okay. Our final budget numbers from fiscal year 2021. You'll notice down on line, there isn't a line, but it's H2H Rio Grande Cell. So there's $3.7 million there, plus some change. There is a proposal that we would like to present now to appropriate, I guess appropriate may not be the right word, but to grant $3 million of those dollars for a proposal within the Salt Lake COC or LHC, affectionately called the Coalition. And I'm just going to go over it here for a moment. So when we sold the Rio Grande property within the Salt Lake COC, this LHC, or when the legislature, I was Senate president at the time, when we went through Operation Rio Grande, when the resource centers were put in motion. They've been now operational for almost 2 years, close to 2 years now. But in the genesis of that effort, there was some statutory language that would be attached to the sale proceeds of the Rio Grande property. And that's on this document, if you'd like to refer to it. But essentially what it says is that 50% will be used to pay down the debt on the resource centers, those resource centers that Shelter of the Homeless own and manage. And there are other providers that actually do the operations in those shelters. And then 50% may be used to provide funding for ongoing operations of one or more homeless service resource centers and for overflow costs. So we do have a proposal that we'd like to present to you briefly today. Please ask questions. We have Lori Hopkins from Shelter of the Homeless here and Kathy Bray from VOA Volunteers of America. If we have some specific questions. So the proposal is this. The VOA operates the detox center on, is it 8th South?
It's 252 West and 1025 South.
Okay, I think a lot of people may be already know about the detox center, which is running at capacity most of the time. And so there's a need for additional beds for detox. VOA is in a negotiation, maybe even further than negotiation now, on a building on Redwood Road that would add a significant amount of beds to detox. And they would like to sell their the current detox building to Shelter the Homeless, who would then use that building, not this winter, but next winter, probably for emergency shelter, for overflow, and so forth. Some of the operations would be yet to be determined. And so we have reviewed this as an office. We feel like this is a good proposal. The continuum of care, or the coalition, Rob is here. There's a letter from Rob in the packet who endorses this proposal that we forward to Shelter of the Homeless $3 million to buy the current detox building that would allow the VOA, Volunteers of America now, to, it would be part of their funds to buy the building on Redwood Road. There'll be some remodeling of that to some degree. And if there's any questions on that, we have people here to answer that. And so we've gone over the statute. We've looked at the legal ramifications. We're recommending as an office that we go ahead and approve that. This needs to be approved by motion and by vote in this meeting. And so, Mr. Chair, that's the presentation. There's in here, there is also a packet of details, which has a broker opinion in the end as to value. Just some information. This was sent out. You know, now would be the time to ask those questions if you have those, and hopefully we can settle that today with a motion and a vote.
Any discussion? Any questions?
I have a question. So I'm pretty familiar with that site, and there's somewhat of a camping issue there. But because the detox center is there and people are contained in it, and I've toured it many times, I don't feel like it causes additional camping or all that. But you basically, all through going up to Paxton, which is further down where it meets transit, you have a railway line that's already very conducive to camping. And you have a lot of development coming around there, and also the 9 South off-ramp, which I think is going to change in the future. I mean, putting the overflow shelter is going to put a tremendous amount of pressure in that neighborhood on a very tiny parcel. And I feel like it's going to flow out to all those rail lines, and especially the walking between shelters. You're almost going to make kind of a line between 4th West or 5th West along that railway all the way over to 15th South. I just think, has anybody looked at the impact in that community? Because an overflow shelter, especially if it's going to run year round and it's only going to be open during the day or overnight in the winter, it's going to put a tremendous amount of impact. And there's a tremendous amount of ability to camp in that area right now.
Any response?
I want to turn it to Rob or Kathy or Larry.
Yeah, I'll speak a little bit, just briefly. So one of the things, we know that we already operate the detox facility there. It's a unique resource in the community. We know we need more of it. That's part of this plan. The other piece is that that property is already zoned appropriately for shelter operations. But I think the long-term strategy, at least for the coalition, is that if we can add short-term flexible overflow opportunities, additional permanent supportive housing opportunities so that we can move people through these resource centers more quickly into permanent solutions, what we're hopeful of is that down the road, and we can't give a specific to this, but we hope that some of these overflow facilities might end up turning into permanent housing for low-income individuals. So the goal is not that this stays in that type of use that we have right now. We really want to move out of overflow. It's not the long-term strategy to always bring on overflow. We really want to support the development of housing so that when we have this flow, we can decrease the overflow.
Well, and maybe this is something I'd ask the mayor. Aaron, sorry to put you on the spot, but like, we already have a hard time really coping with some of the locations there, and this one just seems remarkably challenging. I mean, I give Kathy credit, like doing the detox there has worked really well, but it's a low impact on the neighboring and the community there, because people aren't walking there and leaving. They're usually brought there by police officers or from another facility when they're ready to detox. This is going to be a huge traffic flow through that area, and it's just so conducive to camping right now. I just wonder what the city's plan would be to address that if we were going to have this, because I look at it 5 or 6 years down the road. What does this end up looking like?
Well, I know that this isn't the section of the agenda that talks about the mitigation funding, where Salt Lake City's guaranteed $0 from the state on community impact, which you know very well, Tiff. We have been working to expand our downtown ambassador program south of the Central Business District into the ballpark area. And we're working with the Downtown Alliance for them to be able to staff up. And so far, Salt Lake City would be funding that based on your tax dollars, and that is all, not on any state or other funding. There's also an element you talk of, it's debatable whether or not 9 South off-ramp is ever gonna change after the state just invested $10 million 2 years ago and doing some upgrades on it. I think what's much more likely is the 4th West Rail expansion, which is right now in UTA's hands, Salt Lake City and UTA partnered to do a feasibility study on executing that Fourth West Rail extension, which would go down that angled portion of rail that you're referring to that cuts through the back of this neighborhood and comes out right around the ballpark area. So that is would be a fantastically positive activation, and for all of you are probably not transit nerds, but the short story is we didn't anticipate opportunity zones to come in through that greenery district area, and hundreds of millions of dollars of capital investment wanting to build a lot of housing and a lot of tech and other commercial use in there. And we need to update our transit to be able to meet that sort of those investors. So that is much more likely than the Ninth South off-ramp shortening, I think, and it would be a great activation. But as for the day-to-day maintenance of the area, right now we are faced on our own with Downtown Ambassadors as our best option. I think we're in agreement with the business and the residential community that it's not about policing our way to safe communities all by ourselves, but the Ambassador extension in addition to our growing police efforts. So
I don't have past the 250 people that Salt Lake City capped a shelter at as well.
Say what?
Didn't we cap like the shelter capacity?
We did for the two that exist.
Right, but then would this one be exempt of any cap in the future? So could it grow to 500, 700?
I don't know that question. Rob and Andrew, do you know?
Andrew Johnson, I'm an advisor to the mayor for Salt Lake City. The answer is to have an overflow shelter require a conditional use permit, which is a process that would make those things in place. So that process would still have to happen within Salt Lake City for this to become that. However, there is some stipulation in state law about if the state funds it, it has to pass essentially. So that discussion would happen. I think I sit on the Salt Lake Valley Coalition Bill and Homelessness Steering Committee. From the city perspective, this is a dilemma. I think that we could admit that piece, that there are already several hundred people who are unsheltered in Salt Lake City. And the things that Tiffany's brought up are real. There's pressures across the city right now. We also know that there's very few options to provide this overflow in a year-long, day-in, day-out kind of process. So we have a lot of discussions still to happen, I think, about the operations. Is it all day, all night? Is it seasonal? Is it not? That's a funding question. There's also going to be a lot of pressure, obviously, to have another option within Salt Lake City. Ideally, we'd like to share this, of course, across the county and the state more than we do, but the dilemma right now is there are hundreds of people unsheltered. So this is one way to get to that need immediately, to have a public process within Salt Lake City about the conditional use permit that would be associated with that, most likely, and the stipulations in there. And then a further discussion with the providers and Shelter the Homeless and everyone else about what are the housing options to allow us movement out of those resource centers into housing, which I think Wayne Niederhauser has talked a lot about. That's ultimately what the goal should be, so that none of these overflows or resource centers should always be at max capacity and out of room. We got to keep that housing push forward so that none of them become the magnet you're talking about. But those are all valid concerns, I think, active questions we need to keep answering, and this is not necessarily the solution. So it's a difficult situation that's being approached in a creative way by the providers. But again, it does mean one more resource center in Salt Lake City, potentially, with all of the pressures that you're mentioning.
But what you're telling me is actually because it's state funded, it doesn't have to go through the conditional necessarily. And could grow to 1,000 people.
No, it does have to
it
go.
It does absolutely have to, even with the state funding. Mm-hmm.
But it has to be approved. What the conditions are that are put into the conditional use permit are up to the city council. And I can't speak for the council, but I would be shocked if they were to allow more than they have already allowed for the other resource centers that exist in the city.
There's also a square footage issue in there about the size of the building, a certain number of beds maximum. That building is not necessarily nearly as large as the other one, either.
Okay. Tiffany, I just wanted to add, you know, your concerns are very legitimate. But 2 years ago, we used the old DI building in Sugar House as a winter overflow shelter, and it was run by the Road Home. Anybody who wanted to go in for the night had to meet outside St. Vincent's and get on a bus. there was very little foot traffic. And the community said, you know, are people going to be congregating around here? And they didn't. In the morning, they were either on the bus, a few went up to Fairmont Park, etc. But what happened is the community saw that Road Home was really trying to keep this a safe area. And the community chipped in with water, clothing, and all kinds of help when they saw that homeless people were not congregating around there. And I think the Road Home did a terrific job with the coalition of keeping that area clear and making it very understandable to our homeless friends. You cannot hang around here, otherwise we'll lose this building. And so they did line up very quietly. I was down at St. Vincent's in the evenings getting people on the bus, and most of them appreciated the bus. And then they got a bus back early in the morning and then went into the weekend center. So it can be done if it's done in the right way with everybody collaborating.
I agree with you, but I think part of that was the conditional use. Once you're permanent, it could be like the Road Home downtown. You know, I mean, part of the reason everyone did that and did that because you want to keep that permission going. Once that permission is no longer there, would we have the similar problem? I'm sorry, I'll let everyone know.
Please, Randy, and there's some other questions that have come in. Thank you. So first, I want to applaud the Volunteers of America for expanding the detox center. I am, as one who has taken people who I was caring for to your detox center and seeing the just the tremendous work. It's the Huntsman's recently announced that they're going to invest a significant amount of money in collaboration with the University of Utah to create an emergency psychiatric a clinic down by the county jail. So to Wayne's comments at the beginning of, you know, really going after the root difficulties we're encountering from mental health challenges to substance abuse, I think we're putting our money in the right places, and I love what you're doing. Thank you. I suspect we need more emergency shelter, but I hear the data is really anecdotal. Aaron, you might be getting better data than what is being rumored out there. But I'm told that the beds on average are 95% full across the year. And then I'm told by others that no, it's not even at 50%. There's lots of beds available every night. Those that are on the street are housing resistant, they're rule resistant. Is more shelter, it seems like I'm being callous by asking it, but if we have available beds and the housing resistant and the rural resistant aren't going to them, it doesn't feel like having more beds is the solution, or more emergency shelter beds is the solution. Again, focusing on detox centers, yes, right solution. Focusing on providing behavioral and mental health services, definitely the right solution. So I guess my question, do we have accurate data, and is it objectively verified? Because all I have is anecdote, and the anecdote is, you know, if somebody says I want a bed, I'll come back. They count that as a bed used, and people that come through say, no, there's 50% of the beds are available at 1 in the morning. But I don't know, maybe that's baloney, maybe that's naysayers. I mean, so do we have daily data, and is it accurate?
We do, yeah. Joseph, is there anything that we had been tracking through, gosh, when did we start that tracking for the data? What's that? No. The bed data. A couple years ago.
With the HRCs.
Right after they opened, yes. So we do track that, and we do verify it. I think that we can pretty confidently like give information. If that's something that you want us to bring to the council meeting next time, we could talk a little bit more about that. I just know that we're running low on time. The only other thing that I would add is that as we're talking about overflow, we really are talking about a solution to keep people alive in the winter, right? That is a primary focus, I think, that we've got as we've had conversations. And so while I I think that we all probably agree that we want to focus on housing rather than expanding emergency shelter beds. There is a need right now, and that's just from my perspective for this project.
Stephanie, you indicated you had some other questions coming in.
Yes, we have two questions online. First is David Litback, then will be Sophia DeCaro.
So David Litback, please.
Thank you. My more of a comment than a question. I want to thank Tiffany for the questions that she's asking. Also want to affirm what Pamela Atkinson mentioned about the Sugar House temporary shelter. And just clarify that there was no conditional permit for the temporary shelter in Sugar House. It really was a community and provider effort and city effort to mitigate the impact on the community. I think we also saw the same thing this last year with Mill Creek and doing an overflow shelter in Mill Creek and not experiencing any significant community impact, as well as the hotels that have been set up within Salt Lake City. So I think there is a way. I also want to just reference the proposal that we're talking about 80 to 100 overflow shelter beds. And thank Tricia for her comment that here where you really are talking about keeping people alive and keep people safe during the winter, or even maybe even based in extreme heat. I also want to, from Human Services, acknowledge how important it is that we are expanding our detox beds, and that 70% of individuals being served in these detox beds are individuals experiencing homelessness. So strong connection there. Detox becomes a critical front door to treatment. President Niederhauser, to what you were saying, how we dig deeper than just the housing. So detox becomes critical in achieving some of those goals. I think this is a great proposal. I think it allows us to meet the most critical needs among individuals experiencing homelessness, particularly during the winter months. And also meet some of our critical behavioral health needs. And I also say, just from my previous hat, working for Mayor Mendenhall and Mayor Biskupski, to Randy's question, I've seen the data, studied the data on a daily basis. We are at capacity in the resource centers, 90 to 95% is accurate. And so we definitely do have the need for overflow within the Salt Lake County system. And the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness, which I must reveal a bias I was a former member of, has done a good job in really planning and thinking forward with this proposal, because we know the need is there. And so every winter we are making searches for that overflow. This will be a part of the solution. It's not the solution, but it's definitely part of the solution. So this is definitely a proposal that Human Services would support.
Representative Ellison.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know if we have an official motion before us, but I do want to speak in favor of this proposal. I think that it's been well thought out. I also want to give a shout out to Kathy Bray and the VOA. I know they have available beds because I helped somebody get in the other day on short notice. I think it's important to look back a little bit on our history, and this is going to go a ways back. Pamela may be one of the few people in the room that remember this. It even predates my involvement, but our community rallied together when an individual froze to death on the steps of a church during the winter and said, we're better than this. And that began the Road Home, the Travelers Aid Society Community Shelter, which has been a low barrier shelter. In the past few years, that pendulum swung where we said, you need to meet standards, minimum standards to have a bed. And we've seen the results of that. I look at my office window and I can see the tents. And so if we want that policy as a community, we've got it. I think this proposal, which would be a low barrier shelter, will allow people disabled by brain disease, mental health issues, substance abuse issues, to at least stay safe, to be connected to resources, which we have a lot of development still to do, to get them on the step to help them, step out of homelessness. So anyway, I think this is a strategic move, and It's not lost to me that we've had the first snowfall in the mountains, albeit an anomaly, but winter is coming and we have to act now, and I think this is the best solution before us.
Sophia DeCaro.
Thank you. I know we're running short on time. I have what I hope will be a quick question and answer, more from a funding perspective, and then I'm ready to make a motion. But I just want to make sure that the entity receiving the money and taking this on as an asset, do they have the ability, if they take this on as an asset, to take care of the operations and maintenance costs of taking that on as an asset? Has that been evaluated or will there be additional need there to take care of any ancillary costs that come with taking this on as an asset?
Your response to that question?
I'd be glad to. Laurie Hopkins, Shelter the Homeless. We are.
Can you step up closer to the microphone, please? Thank you.
Absolutely. So we are committed to collaborating just like we do with all of the homeless service funding with the state, the city, the county, and all the private philanthropic donors that we have in order to provide the facilities, maintenance, and utilities. And then the operators are typically the ones that do the request for the operations and services budgets. And we collaborate as a coalition to do the priority funding for that as well. So we will need to put that plan together once we get this further along. But you know, it's no different than any of the other projects we have. We'll collaborate together as a community in order to get them funded.
Okay, I just, that's good to know. So that everyone has that as aware of that as we move forward with this too. With that, I'm prepared to make a motion if the chair is okay with that.
Yes, please, thank you.
I'd like to make a motion for us to provide $3 million from the homeless to housing restricted account for the purchase of the 252 Brooklyn Avenue detox facility to be used for future day shelter and overflow needs.
This is Gail Miller. I would like to second that motion.
Any further discussion? We'll call the question then. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? And the motion passes. We have, thank you very much. We have just a few minutes left and two topics left.
Mr. Chair, can I make a recommendation?
Please.
We will skip item number 6 on for the Office of Homeless Services data team updates. Please read through those. Let us know if you have any questions. And then we can do a follow-up next time if there are any follow-up questions. We do have a couple decisions to make on item number 5.
We will proceed with item number 5. Thank you very much, Tricia. Russell Goodman, please, and Kelly Coster.
Making our way up. Thank you so much, Council, for having us today. We have two motions that we would like you to consider. The first one is in regards to mitigation, and I would turn it to Kelly to discuss that.
Yes. Hi. So as I said, my name is Kelly Coster. I'm a new program specialist to the Office of Homeless Services. So any questions I cannot answer, we will jump back over to Russell. So the first item that we want to talk about is the mitigation fund. This is a fund that was set aside by the state legislature that is providing funding to cities who host homeless services and shelters. According to that state code, it breaks up funding into two different categories. So there's municipalities and then grant eligible cities. The Office of Homeless Services has determined that South Salt Lake City and Midvale City both qualify as municipal funds, or cities that qualify for those municipal funds, and the cities in that category receive 60% of the total funds in the state fund. So it's a little bit complicated, but stay with me. So then the grant eligible cities, which are in a list on this executive summary that you have in your email and perhaps in front of you, include Cedar City, Logan City, Midvale, Ogden, Ridgefield, Salt Lake City, South Salt Lake, and St. George, as well as Utah Department of Public Safety. So between those cities, they are able to apply for the remaining 40% of the funds in that state fund. In terms of dollar amounts, what we're talking about based on estimates from the Utah State Tax Commission, we're looking at about $5.7 million in the total fund. So again, that will be 60% of that, which is looking to be about $3.4 million, will go to those municipalities, which would be Midvale and South Salt Lake. And then the remaining 40%, which is about $2.3 million, will be split between the other cities listed if they choose to apply for them. So the motion today is around allocating for fiscal year 2023, 20% of the total fund to Midvale, 40% to South Salt Lake, and then approval from the council for our office to move forward with the request for proposals for the grant eligible cities, in which case we will have that RFP published by September 13th and then have those responses back and be able to review and score them to provide our funding recommendations to you all for the November meeting. That's really fast. Questions?
This is Michelle Randall in St. George. I have a question.
Yes.
Please.
I'm quite new to this board, so the eligible municipalities are also eligible for the grants. Has that been the way it's been in the past?
Yes.
And why is that?
It's just the way that the state code is written, that they still qualify because they continue to have shelters that meet the size requirements for that grant eligible municipalities, or sorry, grant eligible entities.
Thank you.
There was another question.
From Sophia DeCaro.
Sophia DeCaro, please.
Thank you. So I noticed in the materials here on the list of cities that would have the opportunity to apply that the Utah Department of Public Safety is listed there. I know that's not a, it's a state agency, not a city. So I didn't know if what the money would be used for there, if that was an eligible entity or just needed clarification on that.
Yeah, and that's specifically called out in the grant eligible entity, the chapter of the Utah State Code as being an eligible entity for these funds. They have never applied in the past. They've never shown any interest to apply, but if they were to apply, it would be for the same things that the other cities are required to do. So it would be public safety in and around the homeless resource centers or the shelters in each of those cities.
Wasn't that done by the legislature as kind of a response to the Operation Rio Grande intervention? Okay.
Great.
Any further discussion? Any further questions? We have a motion, please.
I think we have a motion before us, don't we?
I can make a motion if no one else wants to make the motion. I'll go ahead and motion to approve the allocations as suggested by staff. I believe that was 20% to Midvale, 40% to South Salt Lake.
We'll second that.
And I think 40% for the grant program.
Right, that's the other partner.
Yeah.
So Sophia, you want to add that?
40%. Yes, please.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll second Sophia.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed?
So I'm just going to, that sounds like that passes. Let me just inject here. So having been around the state, this mitigation fund has been a topic of discussion with me. And not everybody's happy about it. And I'm probably the first to admit that maybe some fairness issues with it.
So I have actually been, I've reached out to the League of Cities and Towns. We've had a meeting about the mitigation funds. I'm going to be working with them. I've reached out to the, what is it called, the county, it's the county organization, Association of Counties, reached out to them. We're supposed to get a meeting, but I haven't been able to get a meeting with them to talk about this, because I've heard of people wanting to repeal the statute. I've heard about bills wanting to enhance the statute. I can tell you right now that it's only fair that the cities that are impacted with shelters and have the most impact should be getting some help with their mitigation of those issues. Now, maybe that's more on a regional basis. You know, I don't know what the right solution is. But the statute that we did pass in 2018, maybe needs some adjustment. In fact, I would say it would need some change. But the fact that that certain cities are participating a lot more than other cities means that there needs to be a mitigation fund. And, you know, like, for example, Mayor Mendenhall talks about how much they get versus, you know, some of the other cities. You know, that based on the impact probably is, you know, in my opinion, they deserve more. But in order to deal with the public safety issues around homelessness, so that we don't have these issues, so that we can provide ambassadors, so we can provide public safety in and around these shelters where a lot of this activity happens, I would personally oppose any repeal of that. But should we have a discussion on how it could be better? Yes. And I'm involved in that discussion. And I think we should, as a council, need to be involved in that discussion.
Mr. Co-Chair, I would love to see on a future agenda a discussion with this council about legislative possibilities with what you're working on, what you're hearing from the associations you're working with, and actually discuss the elephant in the room, which isn't what proportion of unsheltered or even shelters does a city host, but the zero tolerance for on-street homelessness policy that is enforced by cities across the state that is causing an influx into cities with resource centers. And some of the cities with resource centers are enforcing a zero tolerance policy. So there, it is a tremendous piece of this community impact conversation that is really being, has been ignored. I think it's being talked about more now, but it's, I think it's incumbent upon us in considering if there is a legislative path forward, and if you decide to consult with this council on what we would recommend, what we would support, we need to start talking about the zero tolerance policy that's being enforced across the state.
Thank you very much. Noted. Thank you so much. We have one more item. We better move on very quickly.
Fabulous. So the final item we have from our program side is titled Fall Request for Proposals. After we do our state fiscal year closeout, every year we end up with an amount of money that was unspent that we had allocated in the previous year. And we are seeking approval from this council to take that funding and issue it in an RFP that goes statewide with the schedule that's outlined on that sheet, so that we can fund projects, both new and expand existing projects throughout the state with our unused funding from last year. We don't have the exact number yet. We had some preliminary numbers this morning. We're still trying to get the specifics. But once we have that number, we'll issue that RFP and bring those proposals in the November meeting to this council for approval. Those proposals will be reviewed by our Office of Homeless Services, as well as the Utah Homeless Network, which includes representation from the entire state, from each LHC.
Representative Elison, please.
Do you have a rough estimate or range of what that dollar amount may be?
Can I jump in real quick? You do have on in your packet, we were able to finalize this just this morning. So we've had some staff changes with our finance division, so we've been working hard on that. You'll see on that sheet that you've got there, skip this one. What we're talking about is our mainstream funding sources that we talk about with our presentation. That's going to be the first, if you're looking, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There are six lines, right?
Exclude the 15 million and the 3.7 million.
Thank you. That's an easier way to put it. Yes. So those total, if you look at those five numbers that are on the very right of the side of the page, about 1.9 million.
Please.
Will this be a three-year contract renewal?
Good question.
Yeah, so for the new period, if you look at the bottom of that chart that has under staff recommendations, it starts with December 1 to June 30th. That will be the contract period for any new projects. And then for existing projects, if they're applying for increases in funding and approved for increases, we'll just add that to their existing contract that runs fiscal year 22, which is July 21 to June of 22. So all funding would end June of 22, whether it is new or existing. Depending on when it starts, will be if they're already funded or if it's a brand new project.
Any further questions? Do a motion, please.
I'll motion to accept the allocation plan and dates as recommended.
Second. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Thank you very much. I believe we've finished the agenda for today. May I just take a moment to thank President Meterhauser for his fine work in getting all this ready. Tricia Davis, thank you very much as well. Stephanie and all those who prepared and helped and brought these materials together for consideration. We're grateful to you. Thank you very, very much. And thank you for your attendance. Thank you.
Motion to adjourn.